Good evening and welcome to the Wednesday, December 17th edition of The Talking Show.
On K Chung Radio.
My name's Steve Cato, and I'm here in the studio with none other than Nicholas G. Miller.
That's right. It's great to be here as always, Steve. Such a pleasure to spend every Wednesday evening with you and our listeners and various other folks around the studio.
That's right. That is right. And thank you for making it in. I know that you just rushed right over here from a Hanukkah dinner.
I did. It was my first Hanukkah dinner.
That's funny. I was under the impression that you were actually quite an observant Jew.
Due to my current romantic engagement, I'm learning more.
Right.
More and more every day.
What did you enjoy about Hanukkah dinner?
The latkes.
Oh, yes. The latkes are very good.
The witty banter.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
The things that were pointed out as being goy.
Oh, yeah. They do that to you? They give you... They tell you that...
Oh, that thing you and your family do is goy.
Yeah, it's a goyim thing. You guys do. It's a goy move. I grew up in an extremely Jewish neighborhood, so I was perhaps more aware of what one would do on a Jewish holiday than I was really aware of what's the Pentecost. I am still really unsure about what the Pentecost itself is, even though there are Pentecostal Christians, right, whose whole thing is the Pentecost.
You know, to be honest, I went through the motions with all that stuff. I didn't retain any of it.
Yeah, I was also not raised in the Christian tradition itself either, so I mean, I don't know anything about any of this stuff, but...
I just remember I preferred the churches that had the hymnals built into the back of the benches, because they were beautiful to look at. You could read the lyrics while the guy up there was talking.
Right, right.
Wait, so have you seen Dead Ringers, the Cronenberg movie?
Yeah.
Do you know the opening scene where they're kids and they ask the young woman to mate with him underwater or something like that?
Refresh my memory again?
They have a theory that, what is it? Something about people only have to have sex because they live outside of water. But regardless, they're walking down this street that,
yes,
to me is the street you grew up on. I don't know.
It's the street that I kind of went to high school on.
Okay.
I grew up in a different street, but yeah, that's in North Toronto. It is actually like very imminently recognizable as like a street, maybe not so much me, but a friend of mine
rows of four bedroom houses or something.
Yeah, three, four bedroom houses, right. Brown,
yep.
Brown brick.
Chain link fences maybe, or?
Not so much.
Okay.
But yeah, the neighborhood is immediately recognizable.
Okay.
As a specific Toronto type neighborhood.
Good. Your childhood is coming into relief for me.
Yes. Also, the neighborhood in Videodrome where he breaks through the alley and runs around, that's the neighborhood I spent most of my adult life in.
Excellent.
Yeah, and it hasn't changed that much since the 80s. So, I mean, it's changed a lot since the 80s, but visually, still very similar.
Right. Well, you know, back to our neck of the woods, have you been following this stuff in the news about the new condom law and pornography?
Only insofar as they introduced a law saying that they were mandatory, correct? In the San Fernando Valley or whatever.
Right, and I guess that was 2013 or 12. I think it was some while ago, but it's been the Vivid sued, I guess.
Okay.
And I was reading...
Vivid are a major porn studio?
They are.
Okay.
I think maybe a conglomeration of them sued together.
Uh-huh.
And it
seems like something that the industry would do.
Right. So it was really interesting this morning to read the recent article. I guess the case was finally thrown out.
Oh.
They have to wear condoms in the San Fernando Valley during pornographic shoots. But the interesting thing for our purposes is that... the position that Vivid took was that forcing the male actors to wear condoms was a violation of their freedom of speech. Wrap your head around that one.
I've often wondered if it wasn't, if it wouldn't be more intelligent for there to be mandatory microphone sanitation here at Kaechang. Speaking of condoms and freedom of speech, you know, what about my freedom to not catch a disease from this Kaechang microphone?
From the two true guys.
Not even from the two true guys. Think about all the other shows, far less well-groomed. Then
you know the Japanese,
Joe and Max.
The Japanese put little hairnets on the mics.
The Japanese put little hairnets on the mics, and then they can take the little hairnet off after a speaker's spoken, and
right,
and with it go the speaker's germs.
We could get Solomon to install those plastic bins that they have in the medical examining rooms that say biohazardous on them.
Yeah, and you just dump those in there.
Put your little net in there.
Yeah, afterwards. Yeah. I don't see why not. I mean, if what about other people in the media whose jobs bring them into contact with other people's bodily fluids, i.e. the spit of every other person using these Kaechang microphones? I like the people who have radio shows on Kaechang, but I don't want to make out with all of them.
Well, back to my earlier point, do you think that putting condoms, if you will, on the microphones would be a violation of the other DJ's free speech?
Yeah, that is interesting. The assumption then is that these men are talking with their penises.
That segues pretty nicely into our guest tonight, I think.
Our guest tonight is a timely visitor, because not only is today one of the many days of Hanukkah, but today, Wednesday, December 17th, is also the day that the final Hobbit movie has come out. And this is something that is exciting to some and a complete non-issue to others. But in a way, it does mark what will be a revolution in the economy of New Zealand, no matter how it is, what one's attitude is. So today, more so than perhaps ever, this isn't so much the talking show as it is the Tolkien show. That's right. And we've one up Stephen Colbert, and we don't have Peter Jackson on. We instead have actual J.R.R. Tolkien with us here in the studio.
What does J.R.R. stand for?
John Roland Real.
J.R.R. is nodding yes.
Yes. I believe I mangled the pronunciation of your last middle initial, but...
far too many names to start with.
Yeah, John Roland Reun.
Anyhow, tonight on the talking show, John R.R. Tolkien.
For a while, the three companions remained silent, gazing after Boromir. Then Aragorn spoke. "They will look for him from the White Tower," he said, "but he will not return from mountain or from sea." Then slowly he began to sing. "Through Rohan, over fen and field, where the long grass grows, the west wind comes walking, and about the walls it goes. What news from the west, O wandering wind, you bring to me tonight? Have you seen Boromir the Tall by moon or by starlight? I saw him ride over seven streams, over waters wide and grey. I saw him walk in empty lands until he passed away into the shadows of the north. I saw him then no more. The north wind may have heard the horn of the son of Boromir. O Boromir, from the high walls westward I looked afar, but you came not from the empty lands where no men are." Then Legolas sang. "From the mouths of the sea the south wind flies, from the sandhills and the stones. The wailing of the gulls it bears, and of the gate it moans. What news of the south, O sighing wind, you bring to me at eve? Where now is Boromir the fair? He tarries, and I grieve. Ask not of me where he doth dwell. So many bones there lie on the white shores, and the dark shores under the stormy sky. So many have passed down Anduin to find the flowing sea. Ask of the North Wind news of them the North Wind sends to me. Oh, Boromir, beyond the gate the seaward road runs south, but you came not with the wailing gulls from the grey sea's mouth. Then Aragorn sang again. From the gate of kings the North Wind rise, and past the roaring falls, and clear and cold about the tower its loud horn calls. What news from the north, O mighty wind, do you bring to me today? What news of Boromir the Bold, for he is long away? Beneath Amon Hen I heard his cry, there many foes he fought. His cloven shield, his broken sword, they to the water brought. His head so proud, his face so fair, his limbs they laid to rest. And Rauros, golden Rauros, falls, Borin upon his breast. O Boromir, the Tower of Guard shall ever northward gaze. To Rauros, golden Rauros, falls at the end of day. An Ent, said Merry, what's that? But what do you call yourself? What's your real name? Who now, replied Tyrbeard, who? Now, that would be telling. Not so hasty. But I am doing the asking. You're in my country. What are you, I wonder? I cannot place you. You do not seem to come in the old list that I learned when I was young. But that was long, long time ago. And they may have made new lists. Let me see, how did it go? Learn now the lore of living creatures. First name the four, the free peoples. Eldest of all, the elf children. Dwarf the delver, darker his houses. Ent the earthborn, old as mountains. Man the mortal, master of horses. Beaver the builder, buck the leaper, bear bee hunter, boar the fighter, hound is hungry, hare is fearful. Yes, eagle in eyrie, ox in pasture, hart horn crowned, hawk is swiftest, swan the whitest, serpent coldest. How did it go? Room tum, room tum, room ti tum tum. It was a long list. But anyway, you do not seem to fit in anywhere. Treebeard fell silent, striding along, and yet making hardly a sound with his great feet. Then he began to hum again, and passed into a murmuring chant. Gradually the hobbits became aware that he was chanting to them. In the willow meads of Tasarinan I walked in the spring. Ah, the sight and the smell of the spring in Nandasarion. And I said that was good. I wandered in the summer in the elm woods of Ossiriand. Ah, the light and the music of the summer by the seven rivers of Ossir. And I thought that was best. To the beaches of Neldereth I came in the autumn. Ah, the gold and the red and the sighing of leaves in the autumn in Tower and Aneldor. It was more than my desire. To the pine trees of the highland of Dothanion I climbed in the winter. Ah, the wind and the whiteness and the black branches of winter upon Orthwyn. My voice went up and sang in the sky. And now all those lands lie under the wave, and I walk in Ambarona, in Tower, in Morna, in Aldalome, in my own land, in the country of Fangor, and where the roots are long, and the years lie thicker than the leaves in Tower, in Morna, Lome. There was an Elvish song that spoke of this, or at least so I understand it. It used to be sung up and down the great river. It was never an Entish song, mark you. It would have been a very long song in Entish. But we know it by heart, and hum it now and again. This is how it runs in your tongue. The Ent. When spring unfolds the beechen leaf, and sap is in the bough. When light is on the wildwood stream, and wind is on the brow. When stride is long, and breath is deep, and keen the mountain air. Come back to me, and say, my land is fair. The Entwife. When spring is come to garth and field, and corn is on the blade, when blossom like a shining snow is on the orchard laid, when shower and sun upon the earth with fragrance fill the air, I linger here and will not come, cause my land is fair. The Ent. When summer lies upon the world in a noon of gold, beneath the roof of sleeping leaves, the dreams of trees unfold. When woodland halls are green and cool and wind is in the west, come back to me. Come back to me and say my land is best. The Entwife. When summer warms the hanging fruit and burns the berry brown, when straw is gold and ear is white and harvest comes to town, when honey spills and apple swells, though wind be in the west, I'll linger here beneath the sun, because my land is best. The End. When winter comes, the winter wild that hill and wood shall slay, when trees shall fall and starless night devour the sunless day, when wind is in the deadly east, then in the bitter rain I'll look for thee and call to thee. I'll come to thee again. The Entwife. When winter comes and singing ends, when darkness falls at last, when broken is the barren bough and light and labor past, I'll look for thee and wait for thee until we meet again. Together we will take the road beneath the bitter rain. Both. Together we will take the road that leads into the west, and far away we'll find a land where both our hearts may rest. Then orcs came with axes and cut down my tree. I came and called them with their long names, but they did not quiver. They did not hear or answer, they lay dead. O waro farne lassi, Mr. Carne Mirie, O raw and fair upon your hair, how white the blossom lay. O Rhan mine, I saw you shine upon a summer's day, your rind so bright, your leaves so light, your voice so cool and soft. Upon your head how golden red the crown you bore aloft. O Rhan dead, upon your head your hair is dry and grey. Your crown is spilled, your voice is still forever and a day. O waro farne lassi, Mr. Carne Mirie. Then with a crash came a great ringing shout. Ra! Whom? Ra! The trees quivered and bent as if a gust had struck them. There was another pause, and a marching music began like solemn drums. And above the rolling beats and booms, the swelled voices singing high and strong. Tarun, narun, 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 tahora, kumba, kumba, noon. The Ents were coming. And ever nearer and louder rose their song. Tahura hara lamba noon, da lamba tara munda room, da munda rum, da runda rum, da munda lamba munda tom! Then Brigalad picked up the hobbits and strode from his house. To Isengard, the Ents cried in many voices, to Isengard. To Isengard, though Isengard be ringed and barred with doors of stone, though Isengard be strong and hard and cold as stone and bare as bone, we go, we go, we go to war to hew the stone and break the door. For bowl and bow are burning now, the furnace roars, we go to war. To land of gloom, with tramp of doom, with roll of drum, we come. To Isengard, with doom we come, with doom we come, with doom we come. Thus it runs in the common speech, said Aragorn, as near as I can make it. Where now the horse and the rider? Where is the horn that was blowing? Where is the helm and the hauberk and the bright hair flowing? Where is the hand and the harp-string and the red fire glowing? Where is the spring and the harvest and the tall corn growing? They have passed like rain on the mountain, like a wind in the meadow. The days have gone down in the west behind the hills into shadow. Who shall gather the smoke of the dead wood burning? Or behold the flowing years from the sea returning? Gollum chuckled to himself, sometimes even croaking in a sort of song. The cold, hard lands, they bites our hands, they gnaws our feet. The rocks and stones are like old bones, all bare of meat. But stream and pool is wet and cool, so nice for feet. And now we wish. Aha, what does we wish? He guessed it long ago. Baggins guessed it. Alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsting, ever drinking, clad in mail, never clinking, drowns on dry land, thinks an island is a mountain, thinks a fountain is a puff of air, so sleek, so fair, what a joy to meet. We only wish to catch a fish so juicy, sweet. there any elephants? Asked Sam, forgetting his fear and his eagerness for news of strange places. No, no elephants. What are elephants? Said Gollum. Stan stood up, putting his hands behind his back, as he always did when speaking poetry, and began. Grey as a mouse, big as a house, nose like a snake, I make the earth shake as I tramp through the grass. Trees crack as I pass. With horns in my mouth, I walk in the south, flapping big ears. Beyond count of years, I stomp round and round, never lie on the ground, not even to die. Oliphant am I, biggest of all, huge, old and tall. If ever you'd met me, you wouldn't forget me. If you never do, you won't think I'm true. But old Oliphant am I, and I never lie. A little way back, above the lake, they found a deep brown bed of last year's fern. Beyond it was a thicket of dark-leaved bay trees, climbing up a steep bank that was crowned with old cedars. Here they decided to rest and pass the day, which already promised to be bright and warm. Sam had been giving earnest thought to food as they marched. Now that the despair of the impassable gate was behind him, he did not feel so inclined as his master to take no thought for their livelihood beyond the end of their errand. And anyway, it seemed wiser to him to save the waybread of the elves for worse times ahead. 6 days or more had passed since he reckoned that they had only a bare supply for 3 weeks. If we reach the fire in that time, we'd be lucky at this rate, he thought. And we might be wanting to get back. We might. Besides, at the end of a long night march, and after bathing and drinking, he felt even more hungry than usual. A supper, or a breakfast, by the fire in the old kitchen at Bagshot Row was what he really wanted. An idea struck him, and he turned to Gollum. Gollum had just begun to sneak off on his own, and he was crawling away on all fours through the fern. "Hi, Gollum," said Sam. "Where are you going? Hunting? Well, see here, old noser, you don't like our food, and I'd not be sorry for a change myself. Your new motto's always ready to help. Could you find anything fit for a hungry hobbit?" "Yes, perhaps, yes," said Gollum. "Smeagol always helps, if they asks nicely." "Right," says Sam, "I does ask. And if that isn't nice enough, I begs." Gollum disappeared. He was away some time, and Frodo, after a few mouthfuls of Lembeur, settled down in the deep brown fern and went to sleep. Gollum returned quietly and peered over Sam's shoulder. Looking at Frodo, he shut his eyes and crawled away without a sound. Sam came to him a moment later and found him chewing something and muttering to himself. On the ground beside him lay two small rabbits, which he was beginning to eye greedily.
"Smeagol always helps," he said. "He has brought rabbits, nice rabbits. But Master's gone to sleep, and perhaps Sam wants to sleep. Doesn't want rabbits now. Smeagol tries to help, but he can't catch things all in a minute."
Sam, however, had no objection to rabbit at all, and said so. At least not to cooked rabbit. All hobbits, of course, can cook. They begin to learn the art before their letters, which many never reach. But Sam needed a fire and other things besides. He thought for a bit while he took out his knife, cleaned and whetted it, and began to dress the rabbits. He was not going to leave Frodo alone asleep, even for a few minutes. "Now, Gollum," he said, "I've another job for you. Go and fill these pans with water and bring them back."
"Speak up, we'll fetch water, yes," said Gollum. "But what does the hobbit want all that water for? He's drunk. He's washed."
"Never you mind," said Sam. "If you can't guess, you'll soon find out. And the sooner you fetch the water, the sooner you'll learn. Don't you damage one of my pans, or I'll carve you into mincemeat." While Gollum was away, Sam took another look at Frodo. He was still sleeping quietly, and Sam was now struck most by the leanness of his face and hands. "Too thin and drawn he is," he muttered. "Not right for a hobbit. If I can get these conies cooked, I'm going to wake him up." Sam gathered a pile of the driest fern and then scrambled up the bank, collecting a bundle of twigs and broken wood. The fallen branch of a cedar at the top gave him a good supply. He cut out some turves at the foot of the bank, just outside the fern break, and made a shallow hole and laid his fuel in it. Being handy with flint and tinder, he soon had a small blaze going. It made little or no smoke, but gave off an aromatic scent. He was just stooping over his fire, shielding it and building it up with heavier wood, when Gollum returned, carrying the pans carefully and grumbling to himself. He set the pans down, and then suddenly saw what Sam was doing. He gave a thin, hissing shriek and seemed to be both frightened and angry.
Ah, snow, he cried. No silly hobbits. Foolish, yes, foolish. They mustn't do it.
Mustn't do what? Asked Sam in surprise.
Not make the nasty red tongues, hissed Gollum. Fire, fire, it's dangerous, yes it is. It burns, it kills, and it will bring enemies, yes it will.
I don't think so, said Sam. Don't see why it should, if you don't put wet stuff on it and make a smother. But if it does, it does. I'm going to risk it anyhow. I'm going to stew these conies.
Stew the rabbits, squealed Gollum in dismay. Spoil the beautiful meat Smeagol saved for you, poor hungry Smeagol. What for? What for? Silly hobbit. They're young, they're tender, they're nice. Eat them, eat them.
He clawed at the nearest rabbit, already skinned and lying by the fire. Now, now, said Sam, each to his own fashion. Our bread chokes you, and raw coney chokes me. If you give me a coney, the coney's mine, see? To cook if I have a mind, and I have. You needn't watch me. Go and catch another and eat it as you fancy, somewhere private and out of my sight. Then you won't see the fire, and I shan't see you, and we'll both be the happier. And I'll see the fire don't smoke, if that's any comfort to you. Gollum withdrew, grumbling, and crawled into the fern. Sam busied himself with his pans. What a hobbit needs with coney, he said to himself, is some herbs and roots, especially taters, not to mention bread. Herbs we can manage, seemingly. Gollum, he called softly. Third time pays for all. I want some herbs. Gollum's head peeped out of the fern, but his looks were neither helpful nor friendly. A few bay leaves, some thyme and sage will do before the water boils, said Sam.
No, said Gollum. Smeagol's not pleased, and Smeagol doesn't like smelly leaves. He doesn't eat grasses or roots, no precious. Not till he's starving or very sick, poor Smeagol.
Smeagol will get into real true hot water when this water boils if he don't do as he's asked, growled Sam. Sam will put his head in it, just precious. And I'd make him look for turnips and carrots and taters too, it was the time of the year. I bet there's all sorts of good things running wild in this country. I'd give a lot for half a dozen taters.
Smeagol won't go. Oh, no, precious. Not this time, hissed Gollum. He's frightened, and he's very tired. And this hobbit's not nice. Not nice at all. Smeagol won't grub for roots and carrotses and taters. What's taters, precious, eh? What's taters?
Potatoes, said Sam. The gaffer's delight and rare good ballast for an empty belly. But you won't find any, so you needn't look. But be good, Smeagol, and fetch me the herbs, and I'll think better of you. What's more, if you turn over a new leaf and keep it turned, I'll cook you some taters one of these days, I will. Fried fish and chips, served by S. Gamgee. You couldn't say no to that.
Yes, yes, we could. Spoiling nice fish, scorching it. Give me fish now, and keep nasty chips.
Oh, you're hopeless, said Sam. Go to sleep. So without horn or harp or music of men's voices, the great ride into the east began, which the songs of Rohan were busy for many long lives of men thereafter. From dark dun harrow in the dim morning, with thane and captain rode Thengel's son, to Edoras he came, the ancient halls of the mark wardens mist enshrouded, golden timbers were in gloom mantled. Farewell he bade to his free people, hearth and high seat in the hallowed places, where long he had feasted ere the light faded. Forth rode the king, fear behind him, fate before him, fealty kept he. Oaths he had taken, all fulfilled them. Forth rode Theoden 5 nights and days, east and onward rode the Eor Lingas, through fold and fen march and the Furian wood, 6,000 spears to Sun Landing, Munburg the mighty under Mynd Olwyn, sea king's city in the south kingdom, foe beleaguered, fire encircled. Doom drove them on, darkness took them, horse and horseman, hoof beats afar, sank into silence, so the songs tell us. Then, since we must look for fell deeds and the need of all our strength, said Eomer, I counsel that we rest now, and set out hence by night, And so time our going if we come upon the fields when tomorrow is as light as it will be, or when our Lord gives the signal. To this the king assented, and the captains departed. But soon Elfhelm returned. The scouts have found not the report beyond the Grey Wood Lord, he said, save two men only, two dead men and two dead horses. Well, said Eomer, what of it? This lord, they were errand riders of Gondor. Hiragon was one, maybe. At least his hand still clasped the red arrow, but his head was hewn off. And this also, it was seen by the signs that they were fleeing westward when they fell. As I read it, they found the enemy already on the outwall, or assailing it when they returned, and that would be two nights ago, if they used fresh horses from the posts, as is their wont. They could not reach the city, and they turned back. Alas, said Theoden, then Denethor has heard no news of our riding, and he will despair of our coming. Need brooks no delay, yet late is better than never, said Eomer. And mayhap in this time shall the old saw be proved truer than ever before, since men spoke with mouth. It was night, and either side of the road the hosts of Rohan was moving silently. Now the road, passing about the skirts of Min Doluin, turned southward. Far away and almost straight ahead there was a red glow under the black sky, and the sides of the great mountain loomed dark against it. They were drawing near the Ramas of the Pelennor, but the day was not yet come. The king rode in the midst of the leading company, his household men about him. Elfhelm's Eored came next, and now Merry noticed that Darrenhelm had left his place and in the darkness was moving steadily forward, until at last he was riding just in rear of the king's guard. There came a check. Merry heard voices in front speaking softly. Outriders had come back who had ventured forward almost to the wall. They came to the king. There are great fires, lord, said one. The city is all set about with flame, and the field is full of foes. But all seemed drawn off to the assault. As well as we could guess, there are few left upon the outwall, and they are heedless, busy in destruction. Do you remember the wild man's words, lord, said another? I live upon the open wold in days of peace. Weedfarer is my name, and to me also the air brings messages. Already the wind is turning. There comes a breath out of the south. There is a sea tang in it, faint though it be. The morning will bring new things. Above the reek it'll be dawn when you pass the wall. If you speak truly, Weedfarer, then may you live beyond this day in years of blessedness, said Theoden. He turned to the men of his household who were near, and he spoke now in a clear voice, so that many also of the riders of the first Eored heard him. Now is the hour come, riders of the Mark, sons of Eorl. Foes and fire before you and your homes far behind. Yet though you fight upon an alien field, the glory that you reap there shall be your own forever. Oaths ye have taken, now fulfill them all, to lord, and land, and league of friendship. Men clashed spear upon shield. Eomer, my son, you lead the first Eored, said Theoden. It shall go behind the king's banner in the center. Elfhelm, lead your company to the right when we pass the wall. And Grimbold shall lead his towards the left. Let the other companies behind follow these three that lead as they have chance. Strike wherever the enemy gathers. Other plans we cannot make, for we know not yet how things stand upon the field. Forth now, and fear no darkness. The leading company rode off as swiftly as they could, for it was still deep dark, whatever change Weedfarer might forebode. Merry was riding behind Darrenhelm, clutching with the left hand, while with the other he tried to loosen his sword in its sheath. He felt now bitterly the truth of the old king's words. In such a battle, what would you do, Meriadoc? Just this, he thought, encumber a rider, and hope at best to stay in my seat and not be pounded to death by galloping hoofs. It was no more than a league to where the outwalls had stood. They soon reached them, too soon for Merry. Wild cries broke out, and there was some clash of arms, but it was brief. The orcs busy about the walls were few and amazed, and they were quickly slain or driven off. Before the ruin of the north gate and the Ranmas, the king halted again. First Eored drew up behind him and about him on either side. Darrenhelm kept close to the king, though Elfhelm's company was away on the right. Grimbold's men turned aside and passed round to a great gap in the wall further eastward. Merry peered from behind Darrenhelm's back. Far away, maybe 10 miles or more, there was a great burning. But between it and the riders, lines of fire blazed in a vast crescent, at the nearest point less than a league distant. He could make out little more on the dark plain, and as yet he neither saw any hope of morning, nor felt any wind changed or unchanged. Now silently the host of Rohan moved forward into the field of Gondor, pouring in slowly but steadily like the rising tide through breaches in a dike, with men of thought secure. But the mind and will of the Black Captain were bent wholly on the falling city, and as yet no tidings came to him, warning that his designs held any flaw. After a while the king led his men away somewhat eastward, to come between the fires of the siege and the outer fields. Still they were unchallenged, and still Théoden gave no signal. At last he halted once again. The city was now nearer. A smell of burning was in the air, and a very shadow of death. The horses were uneasy. But the king sat upon Snowmane, motionless, gazing upon the agony of Minas Tirith, as if stricken suddenly by anguish or by dread. He seemed to shrink down, cowed by age. Merry himself felt as if a great weight of horror and doubt had settled on him. His heart beat slowly. Time seemed poised in uncertainty. They were too late. Too late was worse than never. Perhaps Théoden would quail, bow his old head, turn, slink away to hide in the hills. Then suddenly Merry felt it at last, beyond doubt, a change. Wind was in his face. Light was glimmering. Far, far away in the south, the clouds could be dimly seen as remote grey shapes rolling up, drifting. Morning lay beyond them. But at that same moment there was a flash, as if lightning had sprung from the earth beneath the city. For a searing second it stood dazzling far off in black and white, its topmost tower like a glittering needle. And then as the darkness closed again, there came rolling over the fields a great boom. At that sound the bent shape of the king sprang suddenly erect. Tall and proud he seemed again, and rising in his stirrups he cried in a loud voice, more clear than any there had ever heard a mortal man achieve before, "Arise, arise, riders of Théoden! Fell leads awake, fire and slaughter! Spear shall be shaken, shield is splintered, sword day, red day, ere the sun rises! Ride now, ride to Gondor!" With that he seized a great horn from Guthlaf, his banner-bearer, and he blew such a blast upon it that it burst asunder. And straightway all the horns in the host were lifted up in music, and the blowing of the horns of Rohan in that hour was like a storm upon the plain, and a thunder in the mountains. Ride now, ride to Gondor! Suddenly the king cried to Snowmane, and the horse sprang away. Behind him his banner blew in the wind, white horse upon a field of green, but he outpaced it. After him thundered the knights of his house, but he was ever before them. Elmer rode there, the white horse tail on his helm, floating in his speed. On the front of the first Aelred roared like a breaker foaming to the shore, but Théoden could not be overtaken. Fey he seemed, or the battle fury of his fathers ran like new fire in his veins. And he was born upon Snowmen like a god of old, even as Oromir the Great in the battle of the Valar when the world was young. His golden shield was uncovered, and lo, it shone like an image of the sun, and the grass flamed into green above the white feet of his steed. For morning came, morning in a wind from the sea. And darkness was removed, and the hosts of Mordor wailed, and the terror overtook them, and they fled and died, and the hoofs of wrath rode over them. And then all the host of Rohan burst into song, and they sang as they slew, for the joy of battle was on them, and the sound of their singing that was fair and terrible came even to the city. No few had fallen, renowned or nameless, captain or soldier, for it was a great battle. The full count of it no tale has told. So long afterward a maker in Rohan said in his song of the mounds of Munburn, "We heard of the horns in the hills ringing, the swords shining in the south kingdom. Steeds went striding to the stoning land as wind in the morning, war was kindled. There Théoden fell, fangling mighty, to his golden halls and green pastures in the northern fields, never returning. High lord of the host, Harding and Guthlaf, Dúnheron, Dearwin, a doughty Grimbold, Herifaron, Herubrand, Horn, and Fastred fought and fell there in a far country. In the mounds of Munburg and a mould they lie with their league fellows, lords of Gondor. Neither Hirluin the fair to the hills but the sea, nor Forlong the old of the flowering vales ever to Arnach, to his own country, returned in triumph, nor the tall bowmen Derufin and Duilin to their dark waters, mirrors of Morthond and the mountain shadows. Death in the morning and a day's ending, lords took and lowly. Long now they sleep under grass in Gondor by the great river. Gray now steers gleaming silver, red then it rolled roaring water. Foam dyed with blood flamed at sunset, as beacons mountains burned at evening, red fell the dew in Ram Masechor. There the bendy was cut deep through a crag of old weathered stone, once long ago vomited from the mountain's furnaces. Panting under his load, Sam turned the bend, and even as he did so, out of the corner of his eye, he had a glimpse of something falling from the crag, like a small piece of black stone that had toppled off as he passed. A sudden weight smote him, and he crashed forward, tearing the backs of his hands that still clasped his master's. Then he knew what had happened, for above him as he lay, he heard a hated voice. "Wicked master," it hissed, "wicked master. Cheats us, kick Smeagol, Orm. He mustn't go that way. He mustn't hurt Precious. Give it to Smeagol, yes. Give it to us. With a violent heave, Sam rose up. At once he drew his sword, but he could do nothing. Gollum and Frodo were locked together. Gollum was tearing at his master, trying to get at the chain and the ring. This was probably the only thing that could have roused the dying embers of Frodo's heart and will, an attack, an attempt to wrest his treasure from him by force. He fought back with a sudden fury that amazed Sam and Gollum also. Even so, things might have gone far otherwise if Gollum himself had remained unchanged. But whatever dreadful path, lonely and hungry and waterless, he had trodden, driven by a devouring desire and a terrible fear, they had left grievous marks on him. He was a lean, starved, haggard thing, all bones and tight-drawn, sallow skin. A wild light flamed in his eyes, but his malice was no longer matched by his old griping strength. Frodo flung him off and rose up, quivering. "Down! Down!" he gasped, touching to his hand to his breast, so that beneath the cover of his leather shirt he clasped the ring. "Down, you creeping thing, and out of my path! Your time is at an end. You cannot betray me or slay me now." Then suddenly, as before, under the eaves of the Emyn Muir, Sam saw these two rivals with other vision, a crouching shape, scarcely more than the shadow of a living thing, a creature now wholly ruined and defeated, yet filled with a hideous lust and rage. Before it stood stern, untouchable now by pity, a figure robed in white. But at its breast it held a wheel of fire. Out of the fire there spoke a commanding voice. "Begone, and trouble me no more. If you touch me ever again, you shall be cast yourself into the fire of doom." The crouching shape backed away, terror in its blinking eyes, and yet at the same time insatiable desire. Then the vision passed, and Sam saw Frodo standing, hand on his breast, his breath coming in great gasps, and Gollum at his feet, resting on his knees, with his wide splayed hands upon the ground. "Look out!" cried Sam, "he'll spring!" He stepped forward, brandishing his sword. "Quick, master!" he gasped. Go on, no time to lose. I'll deal with him. Go on!" Frodo looked at him as if at one now far away. "Yes, I must go on," he said. "Farewell, Sam. This is the end at last. On Mount Doom, doom shall fall. Farewell." He turned and went on, walking slowly but erect up the climbing path. "Now," said Sam, "at last I can deal with you." He leapt forward with drawn blade ready for battle. But Gollum did not spring. He fell flat upon the ground and whimpered. "Don't kill us," he wept. "Don't hurt us with nasty, cruel steel. Let us live, yes. Live just a little longer. Lost, we're lost. And when Precious goes, we'll die, yes, die into the dust." He clawed up the ashes of his path with his long fleshless fingers. "Dust," he hissed. Sam's hand wavered. His mind was hot with wrath and the memory of evil. It would be just to slay this treacherous, murderous creature. Just and many times deserved. Also, it seemed, the only safe thing to do.
But deep in his heart, there was something that restrained him. He could not strike this thing lying in the dust, forlorn, ruinous, utterly wretched. He himself, though only for a little while, had borne the ring. And now dimly he guessed the agony of Gollum's shriveled mind and body, enslaved to that ring, unable to find peace or relief ever in life again. But Sam had no words to express what he felt. Oh, curse you, you stinking thing, he said. Go away. Be off. I don't trust you. Not as far as I could kick you, but be off, or I shall hurt you. Yes, with nasty, cruel steel. Gollum got up on all fours and backed away for several paces. Then he turned, and as Sam aimed a kick at him, he fled away down the path. Sam gave no more heed to him. He suddenly remembered his master. He looked up the path and could not see him. As fast as he could, he trudged up the road. If he had looked back, he might have seen, not far below, Gollum turn again, and then, with a wild light of madness glaring in his eyes, come, swiftly but warily, creeping on behind, a slinking shadow among the stones. The path climbed on. Soon it bent again, and with a last eastward course, passed in a cutting along the face of the cone, and came to the dark door in the mountainside, the door of the Samath Naur. Far away now, rising towards the south, the sun, piercing the smokes and haze, burned ominous, a dull, bleared disk of red. But all Mordor lay about the mountain like a dead land, silent, shadow-folded, waiting for some dreadful stroke. Sam came to the gaping mouth and peered in. It was dark and hot. A deep rumbling shook the air. Frodo! Master! He called. There was no answer. For a moment he stood, his heart beating with wild fears, and then he plunged in. A shadow followed him. At first he could see nothing. In his great need he drew out once more the phial of Galadriel, but it was pale and cold in his trembling hand, and threw no light into that stifling dark. He was come to the heart of the realm of Sauron, and the forces of his ancient might, greatest in Middle-earth. All other powers were here subdued.
And before the sun had fallen far from the noon, out of the east there came a great eagle flying, and he bore tidings beyond hope from the lords of the west, crying, Sing now, ye people of the Tower of Anor, for the realm of Sauron is ended forever, and the Dark Tower is thrown down. Sing and rejoice, ye people of the Tower of God, for your watch hath not been in vain, and the black gate is broken, and your king hath passed through, and he is victorious. Sing and be glad, all ye children of the west, for your king shall come again, and he shall dwell among you all the days of your life. And the tree that was withered shall be renewed, and he shall plant it in the high places, and the city shall be blessed. Sing, all ye people. And the people sang in all the ways of the city.
Ai, lare lantarlasis urinan, in jaru notin arbir almar aldron, in javil inti julmar van, jermior umar illes immeru voriva, and une bella vardu telumar, nulo in jasent intilari elene, O Mario Aritori Lirinan, si mani yuldanen in quantuva, ansit in tali vardo oiolosseo, le fagna mare delentari ortneari gli artieri undullave l'ombulle, as in dar noriallo caita mornie, I val malinari memet, arisien tu pocalachilio mirioele, si vanno an arrom lo vanno a valimar. Na marie, na iruvalia valimar, na elie
Wow. was strange.
From another planet, even.
Yeah, or this, who knows? Wow. You know, this is a time for me to confess. I was never actually that into Lord of the Rings as a young person. You?
I was mildly engaged. I read them all. I left off at the Silmarillion. That was, you know, someone said, this is, you know, if you really want to find out what's really going on in Middle Earth, you read this one. And I wasn't interested in history at that point, and even less interested in the history of a fantastic world.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a similar experience, only I went a degree shorter in terms of my engagement. I didn't make it all the way through Lord of the Rings. And then someone tried to pull that same move on me, being like, well, the real action's in the Silmarillion. And I got maybe page 2 of that and realized that, like, if I was going to go to a place like that, I'd rather read, like, the Epic of Gilgamesh or something.
Mm. How did that go?
You know, it's surprisingly bawdy. Gilgamesh gets up to a lot of things that the sexless inhabitants of Middle-earth do not.
Mm.
But
elves have sex, right?
I think elves actually really don't.
But they go, you know, a male elf and a female elf, they enter the boudoir, and then, like, you know, something closes and you can't see what happens.
That's probably the case, but I have a feeling that since they're immortal, there's every interest in sort of, so to speak, limiting their freedom of speech,
right,
where that is concerned, or that's not an issue, right? The elves live forever.
Like Bjork.
As will Bjork, and actually, not to out him here, but also Solomon Bothwell, who will never die. But
who's starting a gym, I hear?
Solomon's.
Yep, at Night Gallery?
Yeah, right?
But where? And is there a basement I don't know about?
I was thinking it was going to be in the yard.
That makes more sense.
Yeah. When does Solomon's gym open?
I don't know.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that we'll see Joe and Max from Two True pumping iron in the yard at Shea Solomon, the gym, any minute now.
If Solomon lived in Middle Earth, who would he be?
He would be Saruman.
He's a kind-hearted person. I think Saruman is evil.
Saruman was convinced to become evil.
That's true, by the evil eye.
And by his own sort of immense power.
Mm. I wonder if this gem will be Solomon's evil eye.
I wonder if this will be where he gains too much power for his own good.
And is forced to use it for evil.
When Solomon eventually is able to just press the entire weight of Solomon over his head. When you are able to lift your entire body weight over your head.
And when he can woodwork with only his hands.
Right.
He just he planes and cuts. And
he just rips the wood apart, essentially, and yeah. Forms the atoms at a mental level.
Right.
Yeah. Could you imagine having that kind of power, Nicholas, as a woodworker yourself?
No. I mean, what would I look at on the internet?
Hmm.
I guess guys wearing condoms.
Yeah, maybe some guys now wearing condoms. You could get it really into bike parts. You could get really into, you know, there's a lot of other, you could get really into single origin coffees or scented candles.
I would get really into trains, I think. Little train sets.
Model trains.
Yeah.
There's an amazing model train store in
Glendale or something.
I'm sure there's one in Glendale. But no, the one I was thinking of was out near the airport, Westchester. There's an incredible model train store out there. Really, really incredible the number of little things they have mm-hmm. for your model train set.
Mm-hmm.
They have tiny business people who are rushing. Tiny business people who are satisfied, like for when you build a train station
mm-hmm.
that will be in an urban setting, they have rail cars representing all major shipping conglomerates.
Mm.
They have, of course, locomotives of every kind
right.
at all scales because the bases need Ooh, to be covered.
Do they have little cargo cars full of plywood?
They have little cargo cars full of all kinds of little things. Mm. Coal. Obviously, the tanker cars hold...
Logs. But plywood, I think, probably never entered that lexicon.
Yeah, I think you'd be surprised.
Okay. I love being surprised.
Because there's a burden to accuracy in that world.
Yeah. Have you seen that... what is that? That film in the Criterion Collection about the model train community in San Diego?
No.
Oh, it's amazing. Gosh, I wish I could remember the name. The name's a clever pun, I think.
Well, speaking of finely wrought, intricate models, this concludes our journey to Middle Earth.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Johnny. And see you again sometime soon when we bring you back to sing the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
And or actually, I was thinking maybe you'd like to come along when we bring the Icelandic Saga Chanter in later this year. We still have that on tap, do we not? What's his name? Oh, I can't remember now. It's terrible. But we have an on deck Icelandic Saga Chanter,
mm-hmm,
who will come in whenever he's available, whenever we can work it out.
Yeah. When that grant comes in.
When that grant comes in from the Icelandic Arts Council.
And Saruman.
From Saruman, our friend, the Icelandic Saga Chanter. One ring to bind them all, folks. Uno ring. Hope you've had a great Lord of the Rings Day and a wonderful Hanukkah. Things are going to get a little woolly over the next couple days because the talking show falls on both Christmas and New Year's.
Dun dun dun.
So who knows what's going to happen?
Solomon knows.
Who will never die. In Solomon, amen. Good night, everyone.
Sleep tight.